We'll meet you here next week.
Okay.
Just get here, okay? Have the building already.
Well, it's been, I guess, a couple weeks since I was actually here last week, but I came in really late. So, since I was here, I listened to the classes on the internet that Chris taught the last 2 weeks, and that last chapter was a very challenging chapter. I know Chris said several times in the lesson how that last chapter was, of course, the more you get into the book, it's like every chapter seems more challenging than the last chapter. But talking about the concept of what we give to God, is what we give to God the best that we have, or is it just giving Him something? And Chris brought up a point last week, and this is kind of this will kind of take us into our lesson for this week. But Chris brought up a point last week. In fact, I think it was his question at the very beginning of class. Which is worse, giving God nothing, or giving God just something? Giving God just a little of what we have, or giving Him nothing? Which one is worse? I was thinking about this. Imagine that you are, you could go one of two ways with this. Somebody important is coming to your home. Think about someone in your life that you would say as important. Maybe for Sean, it may be a girl that he's trying to impress, okay? Or for Gloria, it may be a friend that she hadn't seen in a long, long time, and they come into town, and they've been good friends for a long time. Somebody that's done something important for her in her life. For other of us, we're married. Maybe it's our wife, and we're fixing them a very special dinner for our anniversary or something at home. Might do that sometime, Barry. And so they come to the door, and they knock on the door, and you let them in. You say, "I'm so glad that you're here, man. You are so important to me. You're just the primo of importance in my life, and I'm trying. I want to show you the best evening that I possibly can. So let's go on in the kitchen and let's have dinner." So you walk into the kitchen, and immediately they see that nothing is prepared. And so what you do is you walk over to you go, "Okay. Now, I've got a whole fridge full of leftovers. Pick what you want. I got some spaghetti. That's not been there too long. I got some..." And you go through the list of everything that you have left over in your refrigerator that you haven't eaten in the last month. And for, if it's Sean or me or Jared, it's probably stuff that's been in there for a while and not, you know, you wouldn't even want to touch the stuff. It's got some, like, green grass growing on top of it. So, how important does that person feel? How impressed is that girl going to be with Sean? She'll never date him again, right? This person that has come such a long way to visit Gloria, and they're so important, she says, "Oh, you're so important to me." How important do they feel? How important does your wife feel? Our anniversary dinner, honey, I think we have some leftover lasagna from about 2 weeks ago.
She felt pretty good.
Very important. Well, at least she fed her. That's probably better than either.
Exactly.
But think about how you would feel if you were in that position. Would you rather eat leftovers, or would you rather just have not come at all? Which would make you feel worse? I think a person offering the leftovers to them. A person saying, "Here, just, I got some stuff in here, just take something, we'll eat it up, and we'll have, you know." Sometimes, and I think that's kind of where the last chapter was going. But that's how we treat God. "Yeah, God, you can come into my life and you can just have whatever's left over after I'm finished with everything. After I've used stuff up, after I'm taking all the stuff out that I want for myself and is important to me, then you can have everything else." And just imagine how bad that must make God feel in our lives. When that's how we treat Him. It would just be just like, here we are offering someone leftovers who we say is important to us. What it says is, "You're not that important to me." That it's just kind of a show. It's just kind of a, "I'm just offering it to you because I feel like I have to give you something, God. I got to give you something in my life, and so here, take this." And God, I believe, says, "You know, just keep it. Just keep it. If you're not going to give me your best, I don't want anything. And we talked about the passage from Malachi. And actually, this next chapter actually kind of that ends back up with that passage from Malachi, and kind of talks about that again. The next chapter that we're going to look at, and I was actually going to show the little clip, but I couldn't find the DVD. Somebody has done something. Anyway, I looked everywhere. I remember it's called "When You're in Love." And this is not a marriage class or a dating class. Okay, it's going to relate back to God. I remember when I was dating Becky, and Becky was from Oregon. And I think the first summer after we dated, she went home and she spent the summer at home, and we didn't get to see each other at all. We talked on the phone like every night. I'm not much of a phone talker. I don't know most guys are not phone talkers. It consists of the other person on the end of the line talking and us sitting there trying to stay awake. Okay? I hate to say that, but Jared did that to you, Meredith.
No, I did that.
Oh, you did that to him? You're not a phone talker either? Oh, well, I can see that, actually. Jared is... You're sitting there on the other line, on the other end of the phone, and you're just trying to stay awake. But it's different, especially when it's someone that you care about, right? You want to talk to them. You want to spend time with them. But the next summer after that, I can't remember if it was our second summer or the third summer. I think it might have been the third year we dated. She stayed in Searcy, and I came home. And she worked a job there in Searcy. Well, middle of the summer is her birthday, July the 18th. I could just tell, you know, of course, you're missing the person that you care about. And the more that you're away from them, the more that you appreciate them, the more that you want to see them and be with them. And so she was working that job. I could tell she was getting a little bit depressed. She had no friends there for the summer. She was working with a bunch of people she didn't really like. She was working at like a country club, and she didn't like the job, but she knew that she had to make money to pay for college. So she was just working away and slaving away. And so I decided, and it was really kind of spur of the moment, that I was going to drive from my home, and I don't know how I convinced my parents of this, actually, but I was going to drive from my home. Maybe they didn't even know I left. I don't know. But it didn't happen. Just close your ears, Dad. Yeah. And I drove from the afternoon, and I drove to Searcy. And I bought some flowers, and I got her a gift. And when she came out of work, I was standing there. I didn't tell her I was coming. And I just remember the look on her face. It was like, "You're crazy." But it was, she was so happy to see me because I didn't tell her I was coming. And so then I stayed there that night, not with her. I went to stay with a friend that was in school. We went out to eat, and I stayed with my friend. The next morning, she didn't have to work until, I don't know, noon or something. And so we had breakfast, and we walked around campus, and we spent a lot of time together, and then I drove back home the next day because I had to be back for something. I can't remember. But, you know, there aren't many people I'd do that for. In fact, I can't really think of anybody else that I would go to that much trouble to drive that far to spend just a few hours. Probably we spent maybe a total of 3 hours together, and then I came back home. But it was no problem. Anybody relate to that? When you're in love with someone, it is not a chore to go out of your way for them. It is not a chore to do things that are above and beyond the normal when you're in love with that person. He says in this chapter, he says, when you're truly in love, you go to great lengths to be with the one you love. You'll drive for hours to be together, even if it's only for a short while. You don't mind staying up late to talk. Walking in the rain is romantic, not annoying. You'll willingly spend a small fortune on the one you're crazy about. When you're apart from each other, it's painful, even miserable. He or she is all you think about. You jump at any chance to be together. Now, that can go to a point of unhealthiness, can't it? To be so obsessed with someone. But that's not what true love is about. True love is just the desire to be with that person, the desire to interact with that person, to do whatever it, to go at any lengths for them to be in a relationship with you. And the question that he brings up in this book is it possible to develop that type of relationship with God? Is it possible to develop that type of relationship with God. Has anybody in here ever known anyone in your life that has had that type of relationship with God and you noticed it? Anybody want to share? Anybody that had that type of relationship with God? I'll give you my example. Actually, I have probably more than one example in my life, but both sets of my grandparents had that type of relationship with God. I remember my grandmother, me mama, who came to live with us. I don't think it was ever a time that I went into her room that she wasn't reading the Bible, or she wasn't had just read the Bible, or was just getting ready to read the Bible. Sat right by her bedside, and it wasn't just a paperweight like it is for some of us. It was something that was so important to her. And I remember when, I think I told this story in a sermon one time, but she was, after she moved back here, and she was, you know, she was sick, but she was still doing pretty good at the time. And she said, can I talk to you? Can I have a really serious conversation with you? And I thought, uh-oh. What's this about? Something about me, probably. You know, something I'm not doing that she needs to tell me. So she sat down and she said, I'm not sure that I'm saved. And I said, I'm not following you. She said, I've been thinking a whole lot about this. I've been thinking about my relationship with God and my relationship with Christ. And I was baptized at a really young age. I'm just not sure that I knew what I was doing when I was baptized. I'm not sure that my relationship with Christ is what it should be. And what I'd like for you to do, if you don't feel too weird about this or you think it would be okay, is I'd like for you to take me up to the church and I'd like for you to re-baptize me. And this is a lady in her 70s, late 70s. And she was so concerned about her relationship with God. And it wasn't a guilt thing. It wasn't like, oh, I think I'm going to go to hell if I don't. It was, I want to be right. I want to have that right relationship. But I can distinctly remember her being the one, you know, she was always wanting to discuss Bible passages, and she was always wanting to talk about God. And she was always, you could see God in her life. And she had I never really saw this too much, but I'm not sure that she had a very strong prayer life. But a person that you look at and you say, that person is in love with God. That person is in love with Christ. She could not wait to go to worship. She could not wait to go to Bible class and spend time studying. I mean, she was just so excited about it. Anybody else? Anybody that stands out in your mind in your life? You want to share?
I'm not leaving you.
I would say my mom. She is probably one of the most godly women I know. Knows the Bible through and through. I mean, she does prison ministry, everything. But, I don't know. Every time I see her, she's reading the Bible.
Okay.
She's always talking about God. She's trying to convert everyone that she comes in contact with. I mean, she is ready to die now because she knows she's going to heaven. And that confidence is what I strive for. And I think a lot of people that know her, they strive for it too. Because she's just ready.
Okay. And it's obvious in a person's life, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That being a Christian is not a chore. It's not some kind of a checklist. It's something it's who they've become, and it's something that they exude Christ in their life because of the relationship they have with Him. Because of the love that they have. And I don't think it's any irony, that a lot of the people we're going to see in that boat are people that maybe are older in their Christianity. I don't think we need to feel guilty about it. That's one of the things he says. He hates to bring up that last chapter about giving leftovers to God. He doesn't want us to feel guilty about it. But he knows, he says, that, and we all know, it's a process. Building a relationship with anyone is a process. But building a relationship with the God of the universe, maybe even more of a process, more of a time thing than we realize. He has so many more facets than anybody else that we've ever had a relationship with. And how many people in this world, in this life, do we really have that close of a relationship with? Probably count them on one hand. People that we spend day after day with, we spend so many hours with in all different types of situations. And here's the God of the universe that I'm trying to have that type of intimate relationship with. See, God can have that relationship with me immediately. But it takes me a little while to get to that point. But the point he makes is that that's what I'm striving for. Is that type of relationship that I would have with someone that I'm in love with. Someone that I have a desire to be with, that it's not a chore to be a Christian. I thought an interesting quote that he has in here, I'm not sure who the quote's by, but says, "The critical question for our generation and for every generation is this. If you can have heaven with no sickness, with all the friends you ever had on the earth, and all the food you ever liked, all the leisure activities you ever enjoyed, and all the natural beauties you ever saw, all the physical pleasures you ever tasted, and no human conflict or any natural disasters, could you be satisfied with heaven if Christ was not there?" See, I think for many of us, if we had our earthly pleasures, the things that we enjoy on this earth, and we had those things transported to heaven for eternity, and that's what we were able to spend our time around, we might not even notice Christ not being there. If I was in a, and I know this is that way in a marriage relationship, but sometimes I'm not as observant as I should be. Okay, I'll put it very mildly. But you go somewhere, and immediately you notice when your wife's not in the room. I know she notices when you're not in the room because she can't hear you. Right? Where's your? No funny laugh. I can't hear you. But you recognize it, right? I wouldn't want to, you build up your life to have a great life and to spend your retirement years with your wife. Well, I don't care if I have $1 million. I don't care if I have all the nicest cars and all the and a nice home. If my wife's not there with me, what's it worth? Zippo. And same thing, I'm not going to heaven for all the advantages that I'm going to receive. Why do I desire to go to heaven? What's the right answer? I desire to go to heaven because I can spend an eternity with Christ, the one I love the most. The one that I have a desire for. But I'm not sure maybe that that's where I am at this point in my life. And that's definitely where I want to be. Spent some time talking about, actually several weeks, talking about being lukewarm. Looking at Revelation chapter 3. Talking about the lukewarm church in Laodicea. And so, what is it that is the antidote to being lukewarm? What is the antidote to being selfish? To being comfortable? He tells us what it is, and we'll get to that in a second, but he goes through and he tells us some things that it's not. The antidote to being lukewarm is not just to try harder. Just to keep on trying. I think I might have jumped ahead of myself. See if I can find where I am. Try here. The solution isn't to try harder, fail, and then make bigger promises only to fail again. It does no good to muster up more love for God, to will yourself to love Him more. When loving Him becomes obligation, one of the many things we have to do, we end up focusing even more on ourselves. Well, I just don't have the time to love, so I'm just gonna love God more. I'm going to read my Bible more, and I'm going to pray more, and I'm going to go to church more, and I'm going to serve others more. And it becomes this obligation, this obligatory relationship between me and God. That I'm trying my best to love Him, but I'm trying to love Him by doing more stuff. And the more stuff that I do, I realize that I'm not loving God more. I'm just doing more stuff. So he says, it's not the idea of just trying harder. The antidote to being lukewarm is love. And he quotes a passage here. I like this statement here. He says, God wants for us to crave the relationship with Him as we crave all genuine love relationships. Isn't that what brings Him glory? When believers desire Him and are merely not slaves who serve Him out of obligation. Slaves who serve Him out of obligation. You know, one of the advantages of having kids is that, especially when they start getting Casey's age and a little above, is that you can get them to do stuff for you. Okay? As a father. Okay? You can ask him, hey, go get me a glass of tea.
Oh, man.
Go upstairs and now that Courtney's driving, it's like, go get Kelsey from basketball practice. You're going to stay in my chair. But at some point, you want your relationship with your kids to become not one of obligation, but one of love. Right? And it makes a transition of that during I don't know, you don't really know when that happens. It's just, it makes a transition. You do something not because you felt you have to, but you want to because of the love relationship that exists between the two of you. And that's exactly the relationship God wants with us. He doesn't want to, okay, don't steal and don't murder and don't lie and don't cuss and don't all this stuff. And I don't do it. But I don't do it because I feel like that I have to not do it. That God's telling me not to do it. I'm afraid that He's going to punish me if I don't. That I'm just His slave. That I'm just going to do whatever God says, you know, and I've got this bondage and God's the master and I'm the slave. And He just drags me around and tells me what I have to do. Instead of a slave, I need to be what? His servant. Right? What's the difference between the two? Is there a difference between a slave and a servant? What is it? Okay. There's definitely a difference in the two. The two is it's a different mindset. A slave gives you a negative connotation. A servant gives you what? More of a positive connotation. Jesus said we're to be servants of everybody. Well, I'm not supposed to think of that as I'm everybody's slave. Give me $5. Okay, here you go. You know, I'm your slave, and so I'm supposed to be a servant. And that's exactly the relationship that God desires from us. Notice what he says. This is Galatians chapter 5. Galatians 5, 13 and 14. Galatians 5, 13 and 14. It says, you, my brothers, were called to be free. But do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature. Rather, serve one another in love. The entire law is summed up in a single command. What's the command? Love. The entire law is summed up in one word. Love. Because he says, remember the passage, he says, what's the greatest commandment? Is it you shall not kill, shall not murder? Which one? What you're going to get to choose is the greatest commandment. And what does he say? The greatest commandment is summed up in one word. What's the word? Love. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength, with all your soul. What does that do? What difference does that make for me? When I have a relationship that's based on love and not obligation, then I serve God because what? I want to. I'll do the things He asks me, but not because I feel like I have to, but because I want to. Not only do I understand that the things He asks me to do and the things He commands me to do are the right things for me, but I do them because I respect and I love Him. That's why I do them. In a marriage relationship, Look, I always get kidded every time I do a wedding ceremony. I always put part in there about the wife should submit to her husband. Sometimes, I'm going to submit. Sometimes there's a big joke going around about that. But what does that really mean? What does the word submit mean? Jared tells her what to do, and she does it. That's what the word submit means. Right? You didn't know that?
No.
You hadn't been taking advantage of that?
No, I guess I've been slept.
Oh. Is that what it means? She does what he asks, because she understands the relationship that's between them. It's out of love. And he doesn't ask or demand anything of her that's unreasonable because what? Because he loves her. And that's exactly the relationship between God and us. We submit to him because we love him, not because I'm afraid he's going to smack me. He's going to backhand me. I do it because I know that it's best for me, but because I love it. There's another in Galatians chapter 5, verse 6. It says this: the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself in love. I don't know what version this is, but faith expressing itself in love. Is loving God, and by extension, loving people, what you are about? Is it what you're about? I have to admit, and Sean brought this up last week in his lesson, that this whole concept for me was challenged during this last mission trip. When we were serving people who I had generally gotten the idea about that really didn't deserve to be served. They were people who were living on the street and they weren't worth, they stink and they don't have it, you have all these ideas about what these people are like. Well, then when you actually serve them and you get to know them, then you realize what? I was all wrong. There were some of them that were jerks. But for the most part, they were people who were just genuinely trying to make it in life, trying to live. And for them to come in and for me to hand them a sandwich, that was love. That's what they saw from me, was love. Handing them a ham, not even ham, salami sandwich. First day where they were there, they made this peanut butter and syrup mixture. And they slapped it on bread. It was the grossest. I even hated to hand it out to them. And a matter of fact, they'd get it, they'd say, "What we got today? Peanut butter." And they go, "Peanut butter." So I guess they'd had it before. But me handing them that salami sandwich and a little bit of soup that had been overcooked, they interpreted that as love. Just a little bit of service. It took nothing from me. I helped make the sandwiches. I helped stir the soup. But how hard is that? It challenged my whole concept that, there are people in this world, a lot of people in this world that need, everybody needs God. But I may, just by handing them a sandwich, be showing them God's love. And at some point, at the beginning of the week, it was kind of an obligation. Oh, here comes some people again. Here comes that one guy. He's a nutbag. He's a nutcase. There's several of them. They come in and they just not all there. Here he comes again. Old truck. Different guys like that. They come in and you're like, but then by the end of the week, you're like, I ain't seen truck today. Looking forward to seeing, we're looking forward to spending time with these guys. And that's kind of the progression of what he talks about, that our whole existence, the center of our whole existence is supposed to be about love. There's no coincidence that the Bible says that they will know we are Christians by our love. There's no coincidence in that. And it's not just a love for God, but as an extension of our love for God, it's a love for mankind. The more that I love God, the more of a loving relationship I have with him, the more I will turn and I will love other people, because that's what he asked me to do. And once I do that more and more, I realize this is awesome. It's great to spend time and to love those that are around me, even though some people say they're the ones that are unlovable. Think about Jesus' life. Who were the ones that he spent his time with? Who were the ones that he spent his valuable moments with on this earth, for the most part? He didn't spend them in theological discussions and in at rich people's parties and all these places. Where did he spend them? He spent them like we spent them last week, in the gutter. Handing out sandwiches to people who just weren't doing well. Spending time like we did at our hotel with prostitutes. Not in our hotel, but they were at our hotel. You see these people and you're like, ugh. But that's not supposed to be our attitude. But that all stems from my relationship with God. What's it like? Is my relationship with God one that shows love? I want to finish up with this one thing. He says, there's often a great disparity between how we feel about faith and how we are meant to feel. Why do so few people genuinely find joy and pleasure in their relationship with God? Walk into a church service sometime that's not our own. What does the audience look like? Do they look happy?
If the skies are above your grave.
They look like they sucked on pickles. Somebody walks into our... Here's the thing. Here's been our strategy for reaching the lost. Put it on our sign. Come visit our worship services. That's the worst thing they could do. They come into our worship services not only if they're not dressed right and they don't know exactly what to do, are they treated like outsiders, then they come sit down and everybody acts like they're a funeral. Now, I'm not saying we have to be dancing around and all that kind of stuff, but the point is, where's the joy? Where's the excitement about worshiping God? Where is it? In most places, it is non-existent. Why do most people feel like they either have to pay God back for all he's done by his love, or somehow keep making up for all their inadequacies and failures, prove their love? Why are the words of Psalm 63, 1-5 not an honest reflection of our days, of our lives on most days? And this was our key a couple of weeks ago. Chris talked about our camp and the theme of our camp. This was our key verse for camp this year. Psalm 63, 1-5. Oh God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water. I have seen you in the sanctuary and beheld your power and glory. Because your love is better than life, my lips will glorify you. I will praise you as long as I live, and in your name I will lift up my hands. My soul will be satisfied as with the richest of foods. With singing lips, my mouth will praise you. Does that reflect most of our attitudes most of the time? That should be our theme verse. It should be the theme of our life. And the thing is, it can't be forced. Ever had a relationship where you like somebody and they didn't like you? Anybody ever been in that type of relationship? Maybe a guy-girl relationship where you were wanting that person to like you back and they didn't? And you did everything you could. You changed the way you dressed. You acted different. You took them out for big fancy dinners. You did all this kind of stuff. That's not what does it. You can't buy somebody's love, right? It's not something that can be forced. I can't just, okay, today I'm going to earnestly seek God. I just feel that in my heart. It's a natural response to our love for them. And that's the challenge. And Chris will challenge us next week. I won't be here next week. But he'll be able to probably finish this chapter next week. Here's what I want the homework for next week. If you have some time, is take a look at Revelation, the chapter in Revelation where it talks about the church in Laodicea. What is the solution to the problem? He says that they're lukewarm and he's going to spew them out of their mouth. He doesn't just say, "All right, all you guys are just going to hell." That's not what he says. He gives them a solution. And that's kind of where the lesson leads next week. Pick it up in the next little section, is what is the solution to our being lukewarm?
Okay. Yes.
Yes, I did.
I sure did.